Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading in Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 6, Chapter 9, The Appearance of the Demon, Vritrasura, this morning, text 41. The demigods are continuing their prayers. We're almost finished. This once again is in prose and it's fairly long. Can't fit on the board. So I'll just read it through at once in Sanskrit and then we'll try the word for word responsively. O Lord, we are all surrendered souls at your lotus feet. Indeed, our minds are bound to your lotus feet in meditation by chains of love. Now, please manifest your incarnation. Accepting us as your own eternal servants and devotees, be pleased with us and sympathetic toward us. By your love-filled glance, with its cool and pleasing smile of sympathy, and by the sweet nectarian words emanating from your beautiful face, free us from the anxiety caused by this Vritrasura, who always pains the cores of our hearts. Srila Prabhupada's purport. Lord Brahma is considered the father of the demigods, but Krishna or Lord Vishnu is the father of Brahma because Brahma took birth from the lotus flower growing from the Lord's abdomen. That's purport. So Prabhupada's just commenting on this word, this compound, ta-ta-ta-ta. Ta-ta-ta-ta sounds like a drum beat. Ta-ta, father. So the father of the demigods is considered to be Lord Brahma, it says here. So the father of the father is the grandfather, therefore that's Vishnu, because Brahma is born from him. So he's the son of Vishnu. He's called, sometimes Brahma is called Swayambhu, which means born out of his own self. That's because he has no material birth. He's the first created being. So his source is not material. It doesn't come out of primordial soup. You know, you've heard of the primordial soup. You buy it at the Acme in cans. Huh? This is the theory. I'd advocated it one time. I guess it's still there. Yes, it's still there. That there was a brew, you know, chemical brew. Sometime early on, before life had appeared on Earth. And this had all kinds of floating amino acids and stuff like that. And all the components of life were there, and somehow or other in this primordial soup, maybe getting discharged all the time, electrical discharges going on, you know, life came out. I remember as a kid reading a comic book, and it showed a pond in which some industrial waste was being dumped, and that when this pond was struck by lightning and this blob comes out and goes on to terrorize the town. Basically, this is the idea. Except that blob is the origin of all life. So you want to notice here that there are two different, these two contrasting scenarios, two contrasting versions of how things come about. Here you have about us, we start with what we can see, which is this variegated world with human beings, civilized human beings, uncivilized human beings, animals, and so on. A whole panoply of existence, animals, plants, all the varieties. And then one actually begins to wonder, how did this get here? Where did it all come from? What is its source? Everyone wonders about these things. So we have from Srimad Bhagavatam one kind of answer, and we have from the modern material scientists quite different sort of answer. And we can focus on what is the first life to appear in the universe. So here, that first life is Tata. It is a Brahma, the first created being is Brahma. That's what comes out. Super intelligent, highly educated, smart beyond anything we could know. In fact, a fully qualified engineer. Prabhupada calls him the engineer of the universe. He's called, one of Brahma's names is Vedagarbha, which means that he's impregnated with the Vedas. So he knows everything. And he constructs the universe. Vedagarbha means he has the blueprints for how to do it. That essentially is a set of instructions, blueprints, algorithms, procedures for making, constructing a universe, how to do it. This is part of what's in the Vedas, how to put it together. And also, he's provided with ingredients. And so with these two things, the super intelligent first being creates everything. But then you have to ask, well, if here, for all practical purposes, Brahma, let's say he pops out of the void, because where he comes from is transcendental, we can't see. All that's seen is there's Brahma. Similarly, he's on a lotus flower, so bang, he's there. Equipped. Real smart. So you tend to ask, you see, where did he get it from? Where did he come from? That's something like Brahma, complicated, smart, equipped, just happens without a cause, the mind boggles. So we want to say, well, okay, where does he come from? Because we would say that what he comes from has to have all that stuff too. That Brahma, where does he get it from? Because we generally want to say that the causes are greater than the effects. So, Brahma himself wondered where he came from. That's why he went searching down to see where this lotus, the origin of this lotus, was. And then when his son, Narada Muni, he thought Brahma was the supreme, but he saw that Brahma was meditating. So he knew there was something higher, so he asked him after his origin. So that origin is described as Krishna, grandfather. And then when you see Krishna, he's fully equipped, he has all knowledge. So you can ask the same question. Where does Krishna derive it from? What is his cause? But we say it ends in Krishna. Well, how can it end in Krishna? It doesn't end in Brahma. Why does it end in Krishna? And then wouldn't there be a regress. What's his cause? What's his cause? What's his cause? And so on. Well, if with an infinite regress, you never answer the question of where it comes from. You just keep postponing it and pushing it back further and further and further. But again, you never have an answer. So the conclusion is there ultimately has to be that which causes everything and which has no other cause itself. And this is the notion of an absolute truth. Absolute here means has no cause. Therefore, his existence is not dependent. Brahma's existence is dependent. He has a cause. He comes into being by the agency of something else. But Krishna's existence is not dependent. See, here you have in this world, beings, the word in philosophy is contingent. Contingent beings. That is to say, my existence or my nature depends on other things. My life is being sustained because a whole group of other effects are there. Those effects disappear. I disappear. I'm contingent. I may be or I may not be. But the idea of the absolute truth is different. His being is not, he's not contingent. He doesn't depend upon anything else or his existence. It has been argued that if you ask the question, is there a God, or does God exist or does God not exist, you're not even talking about God, because God is such a being that if you think he might exist or might not exist, you're not thinking about God. God's a kind of a being that he exists without any possibility of not existing. There's a famous ontological argument for the existence of God. He exists so truly that he doesn't even have the possibility of not. I may exist, but I have the possibility of not existing. This book exists, or the harmonium exists, but it has the possibility of not existing. It goes into being. When we talk about the absolute truth, we come to a different category of entity. He exists so truly that he exists without even the possibility of not existing. So if we're inquiring into that possibility, we're not even focused on the right subject. We're mistaking God, the subject of God. So therefore, if you really understand what is meant by God, you have to understand that he exists, and not only exists, but exists without the possibility of not existing. That's the way the argument goes. Anyway, of course, people have been disputing this one for centuries, but in the West, it was made up by St. Anselm, who really got it from St. Augustine. But that, at least this, whether it's valid or not, is another thing. But it describes what we mean when we come to the absolute truth. So we're contingent. We're receiving supplies. We're receiving energy. We're being sustained by something else. But finally you come to a being who sustains everyone but doesn't require any sustenance for himself. That means although he sustains everyone and he puts out energy and doesn't receive any energy, he'll still never run out. Therefore, Purnam. It's so complete, you won't ever be depleted. This way is like infinity. You take infinity and you subtract infinity, you still get infinity. It's like a pizza pie. You just take out pieces and pieces and pieces, and the pie remains whole. This would cause big changes in the economy. This is the nature of absolute truth. So, he's in a different position. Krishna's in a different position. So that's what we have to start with. So So you start with the greatest of all, and then the first created being is Lord Brahma. And then from him, the creation comes down one thing after another. So this is one picture of how things come about. In stark contrast with that is the picture that is more and more predominating in the world today. But which has already been described. I forgot Krishna just how exactly. Asatyam. They say he's describing the demons. Asatyam. Apratishtam. This is their description of the world, Krishna says. It's asatyam. It has no reality. Apratishtam. It has no basis or support or foundation. Remember, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Brahmanohi pratishtaham. I am the basis or the foundation or support of Brahman. Pratishta. Pratishta. Shta means to stand. So prati means to stand beneath. Pratishta. So you uphold it. So the demons say, he's describing their view, asatya, this creation is asat. It is unreal. That is to say that behind it or within it, there is nothing that, everything is contingent. It's all one big accident. But here, asatyam, apratishtam, it has no foundation or support. Asatyam apratishtam te jagad ahur. Te jagad ahur. They say jagat about the world. Anishvara. And it has no ishvara. It has no lord or no controller. Or no master. Aparaspara sambhutam. Sambhuta means it has come into being aparasparam, with no cause. That's very bold, aparasparam, no cause. It has arisen causelessly. Kimanyat kama haitukam. And there is nothing else keeping things going but lust. Heat. A more generalized form of lust, just will, life force. There was a German philosopher named Schopenhauer. He wrote a book called Die Welt als Wille und Vorstellung, the world as a will and a representation, appearance. Vorstellung is like an appearance, a presentation. He is a 19th century person. And he was one of the first German philosophers to read the Vedas, except he didn't have access to the author, anything authorized. What he had access to in those days was a Latin translation of a Persian translation of the Upanishads. So he read the Upanishads. Now earlier there had been the great German philosopher Immanuel Kant. So Immanuel Kant's contribution, they like to call it a contribution, was to argue this idea that human mind structures the reality that we see. That there are certain ways reality appears to us that are a priori, so that it has to be that way, and it has to be that way because of the structure of our own minds. And so Kant brought into vogue these two terms, phenomenal and noumenal existence, which Prabhupada uses sometimes. Phenomenal means the world as it appears to us, structured by the categories of our perception and thinking. And then beyond that, there's the noumenal world, which he called the thing in itself, the thing an sich, the thing in itself, which was unknowable by us. There's no way to do this. So this was what Kant did. So Schopenhauer, having read the Italian, Latin translations of the Persian translations of the Upanishads, identified Kant's Ding an sich with the Brahman of the Upanishads. But then he went one step further and he said that I want to tell you what this thing, and it's not unknowable, this one underlying thing in itself that is called Brahman, of which everything is an expression. Schopenhauer said it is the will. He called it the will. So the will is one homogeneous, unified appetite. And that's the driving force behind creation. And this will is especially manifest in the striving to possess, to conquer, and to enjoy. And everything we see is a manifestation of the will. It especially comes out in sexual passion and in warfare. In describing conflict, you know, among beings on the earth, Schopenhauer had a phrase, he says, the will sinks its teeth into itself. Because it's really one will, of which these individuals are just phenomenal appearances. So here, that's what it says, said, kim manyat kama haitukam. It has no other cause but lust, because that's the will. The will is the antecedent of Freud's unconscious, you know, later on. Later on, Freud got this idea that we're all motivated by id, you know, that we have our conscious minds. Below that is the id. In German is das Es, the it, which forces us to act in various ways according to like desires which are consciously unacceptable to us. And so we keep them underground. But that notion of this vast reservoir of underground, unacceptable, just nasty desires, that's there in Schopenhauer. So that's what happens when the idea of Brahman trickles west. Gets identified. This is what happens when you speculate. And notice how, because of that expression, he identifies Brahman with essentially the mode of passion. You can see he's in the mode of passion. So here, the kim manyat kama haitukam. That has no other cause but lust. It's simply lust. So this is the demonic view of things. So there are various expressions of it, but basically the idea is now to make this view plausible to people, to make it seem acceptable. So you go back and back and you try to account for everything coming into being, as it says here, aparaspara sambhutam, without any cause. You start with the Big Bang, the so-called Big Bang theory, with the appearance, the inexplicable appearance. You know, there's just these quantum mechanic waves, and there's before the quantum mechanic waves, there's some kind of ripple in existence, and there's a point that appears. This point doesn't appear in space because all space is inside of it. It's priority space. It is a point, huh?
They call it the quantum vacuum.
Yeah. And this point is infinitesimally small and has infinite mass. And then it just so happens that this point begins to, call it, explode, unfold. And as it unfolds, space, time, all manifest themselves. Super high energy, and it begins to cool as it unfolds. They're building faster and faster accelerators because they think the higher energy state they can collide protons into, at the higher and higher energies, they come closer and closer to reproducing the original state of things. It's a kind of archaeology, which they're trying to do, this high-energy physics. So anyway, this way they're trying to create this, recreate this Big Bang, understand it. But the question is, where does it come from? That's an unaskable question. The rule is you don't ask the question. If in a physics department you ask the question, they say, you know, why don't you go over to the religion department? You don't belong here. The ground rules are you don't ask the question. And then how out of this Big Bang do things develop? Well, they want to give a very, very long period of time when things are just bumping around at random. Random means no cause. The world they think is described right now by the equations of quantum mechanics. In quantum mechanics, they're not sufficient. Quantum mechanics by itself is not sufficient to produce the world that we have around us. It actually gives a field of possibilities, only one of which is manifest. There's a famous paradox of Schrödinger's cat, that according to quantum mechanics, a cat must be both alive and dead at the same time. As soon as you observe consciously, things have to be one way and not another way, but that's not provided for in the formula of quantum mechanics. So in quantum mechanics, there has to be something called the reduction of the wave packet. There's a wave which gives the world, and the world simultaneously can be all kinds of different ways at once. But conscious perception shows it's one way or not another way. According to the pure quantum mechanic formula, a particular cat may be alive or dead at the same time. Cat's part of a thoughtic experiment, which I can't describe right now. So they introduce something called the reduction of the wave packet, which happens all the time and is completely causeless. It's absolutely random. It's not that there's some other law underneath it that does this. It just happens. So right in the basis of physics is this notion of absolute chance. And that's how this world evolves. It's chance. things happen just to bump into each other in the right way, at the right time, and things get more and more complicated. Now what chance is, as an explanation, it's the absence of an explanation. And you might as well, once you accept the idea of chance, you might as well say that Brahma came into being, fully equipped with all knowledge, and he had no cause. That's what you might as well accept it. If chance can produce this world as it is, all they do, see, is they want to trickle the chance in tiny little bits over a long period of time, so it looks more plausible. But it amounts to the same thing. So you might as well say that the whole world, just as it is, popped into being out of nothing. They're simply taking that hypothesis mentioned here, of purasparasambhutam, and trying to make it sound plausible. That you start with nothing and you get everything. That effects exceed and transcend their causes. Which means that things simply happen. Well, now the question is whether you want to believe it or not. It seems to me that the notion of an absolute truth, they may say, well, that's an act of faith, but that's a whole lot more plausible than the act of faith required to think that say that things just pop into existence. Asatyam, apatishtam, anishvaram, aparasparam, all these conditions. But this is the demonic picture of the world. So there's this is what is really at stake, all this stuff about evolution and so on. The doctrine of evolution is just one part of this whole scheme. To make it sound plausible that there's no God, no absolute truth. There's a very heavy, you don't understand what it means, no God. You have to understand that it means no absolute truth. So that really all there is a void. And for some inexplicable reason, there's some little disturbance in the void. And that's the world around us. And this disturbance in the void is absolutely absurd. That it should be there at all. That it should exist. There's no reason for it. That's what you have to accept. So all these philosophies are there. It's there in Buddhist philosophy and existentialism and modern science. The beginnings of it, parts of it there. Schopenhauer and so on. You see it all over the place. So the Krishna consciousness is again reintroducing a very powerful way. Nowhere has it ever been popularly preached all over that Krishna is the absolute truth, or even that God is the absolute truth. When people talk about God in the West, they're not clear what they mean. Prabhupada begins Bhagavatam with saying that the Bhagavatam aims at the absolute truth, and the idea of the absolute truth is different from the idea of God. Although we use them as, God means Ishwara, means a controller. In principle, there can be many gods, but there can only be one absolute truth. Absolute truth means the ultimate source of all energies. So you have to get people thinking in the right categories. You can think that there's no God and still believe in an absolute truth, logically speaking. Mayavadis do that. At least some of them. There could be many, many demigods, but one absolute truth, for example. Anyway, we say Krishna is the cause of all causes. That is more precise to say he is the absolute truth. We say he's God, but more precise ideas, he's the absolute truth. In other words, the idea of God is not wrong, that Krishna is God, is not, that's a wrong statement. But to understand the meaning, you have to understand that we're talking about the absolute truth. And people generally have no notion. Their idea of God doesn't encompass this notion of the absolute truth because they've not been taught properly. They just think he's the controller. But the actual idea is the ultimate source of all energies, the support, the sustain. Oh, philosophers have always had this idea, theologians, but it doesn't get very far past them. They have trouble understanding it and dealing with it too. As soon as they start talking about the absolute truth, immediately they think something impersonal. So they've never been able to integrate the idea of God with the idea of the absolute truth very successfully. So this is a revolutionary contribution that Krishna consciousness is making. All of Western civilization has broken loose from God and has gone drifting off. So our business is to reconnect. We can do that with this philosophy of Krishna consciousness. So these are two different ways of looking at things. That Krishna comes and the first created being is Brahma, most intelligent, not some, you know, proto-cell coming out of a chemical soup, but the most intelligent being. So you start with the greatest and then the world comes down from that. Not that you start with the least and somehow or other everything comes out of there. That's just nonsense. But the nonsense that people are believing. Why do they want it? Because they believe it? Because they want to believe it. They have reasons for wanting there to be no Anishwaram, Apratishtam. They have reasons. Because then they think they can be the enjoyer and controller. They create this world of Maya, cut off from the absolute truth. As soon as you're cut off from the absolute truth, this is the description of a world cut loose. Asatyam, Apratishtam. You notice how things are getting increasingly asatyam, temporary. Now that they've cut off from the absolute truth, everything is temporary. Everything is throwaway. Families are temporary. They used to last longer. Furniture used to last longer. They say they don't make things like they used to. Everything is made to go fast. Fads come and go very, very quickly. Everything, more and more, temporary, and they're more and more asat, unreal. People change their identities back and forth, you know. They put on different costumes, different hairstyles, change their sex, their gender, whatever, back and forth. Move from one scene to the other, you know. Asatyam, there's no identity anymore. They're not anchored to any kind of reality. Apratishtam, no foundation. There's no absolute truth. So you ask anybody, what is truth? Well, whatever you believe is true, that's true for you. So everyone's God, making up their own true for you little thing. Anishwaram, there's no controller. Society becomes more and more chaotic. You can see these effects. What happens when you get cut off? How increasingly unreal and unauthentic everything becomes in the course of time. Any questions or comments? Yes?
I had a question, but first I wanted to summarize a little bit what led up to the question to make sure that I understood what you said. I think you were saying that Schopenhauer was referring to the noumenal things, or the thing in itself, being unknowable.
No, Kant said it was unknowable.
Kant said that.
Yeah. a novel.
And that it was Schopenhauer then who came?
Yeah, Schopenhauer said actually what it is the will.
Developed
okay. As Wille und Vorstellung. Yeah.
Then,
the world is a will and an idea. It's usually as will and idea. It's usually translated like that.
Right. So, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that now I will explain the knowable, knowing which you shall taste the eternal, which is beyond the cause and effect of this material world. So, in basic, he's saying that Brahman is knowable, whereas the material world is unknowable. And I always wondered about that. And then you were saying that he was.
Wait a minute. He said what? He said, "I shall."
Now I
shall. Yeah. What verse is that? Is text? It's.
Sorry, I don't know.
Well, the word is Jnayam.
Now I will explain. Knowable, knowing which you shall taste the eternal. This is beyond the cause and effect.
So this is the 13th chapter.
This is Brahma, which is beginningless. I was thinking about the meaning of that. I just wondered what how you were conceiving this.
Okay, just a minute. Jnayam, yat tat pravakshami. Now I shall explain what is jnayam, knowable, knowing which one shall taste nectar. Anadi, it is beginningless. Matparam, subordinate to me. Brahma, spirit. It is said to be neither sat or asat, beyond the cause and effect of this material world. Now he begins to explain the knowable, first the soul and then the supersoul. So two things. So he explains the supersoul, the soul and the supersoul. And that's what's meant by the knowable. So what do you want to know about?
Well, I was just wondering about the meaning of the knowable, whereas he's contrasting this to what went before, which I believe was the field of, the field, the material world, which is unknowable. He's saying this is knowable, and implicitly what went before that.
No. I don't think it means that implicitly everything under it is unknowable, because he's described it. Because the field, we know what the field is. It's just that it's what is jnaya means. It's knowledge in the pregnant sense of the term. That if you know the field without knowing the knowable, then you've got you're in ignorance. So you have to know it all together. So I would say that knowing the soul and the supersoul automatically, you also know matter. Because Prabhupada defines throughout the Bhagavad Gita, knowledge means to know matter, to know spirit, and the controller of both. It has to be. What he does is, in this chapter, the word jnayam, I'm sure, occurs in various passages. In the when he asks him, explain jnayam, that means that in the Upanishad somewhere jnayam occurs, and it's a topic of controversy. What is this jnayam? What is it? Is it one? Is it many? What is the knowable? Meaning that when those who are engaged in jnana or vijnana, trying to understand Brahman, the object that they're seeking is called jnayam. Now what is that? He's asking Krishna to explain it. So, which he does. And he says, Jnanam, Jnayam, Jnanagamyam. He is the object of knowledge. He is knowledge, the object of knowledge, the goal of knowledge. He is situated in everyone's heart. So these are the Kshetram, the Jnanam, the Jnayam. These are all terms, technical terms, that he's explaining. that have been controversial. That's what's going on in that chapter. But it doesn't imply that the other things are not knowable.
I was thinking of, I had an idea I'd like to get your response to it. I was thinking that I can know you because you're a person, you can reveal yourself to me. Not only that, but you are eternally the same, so that I can actually know you. But any material thing, first of all, it can't communicate with me, and second of all, it doesn't remain the same. It continually changes, so therefore I can't really know what it is. It's just an illusion in a sense.
Well, you can't really know the different manifestations of it. You know, matter itself is eternal also. But it's different manifestations of matter. They're also changing. So you can't really grasp it the way you can grasp something spiritual, because it's asat, it's unreal. That's a fact. Yeah.
In that sense, we can't really know each other in terms of our material identity.
Yeah, it depends on how good your astrologer is, right? Depends on how good your astrologer is, right? But that's true, because you're not really there to know in terms of the material identity. At least you can know better somebody's spiritual nature if you know how to discern it. Almost time to stop. This is short?
Yeah, it's very short. Actually, it doesn't really comment on what the Buddha's tongue.
Yeah.
Unless you really realize into a platform, you see things as they are, you're not able to perceive anybody according to this true nature. So therefore, I'm not qualified to know you or to know myself or to know anybody.
That's right.
Right? So basically, that's why...
You have to see in relationship to Krishna, then you see things as they are.
So this is just a little bit... And then there's a whole bunch of other things like...
Well, we don't have time for a whole bunch of other things.
It's simple. Brahma came equipped with all knowledge. Now we, within a super soul, we also have the same quality that exists essentially within the world of knowledge.
Well, Krishna has it. Whether he gives it to you or not, that's...
But Krishna exists within you, right?
Yeah.
So neither is that.
But he's not you.
Of course he's not.
Okay.
But
so
the essential quality is that we are particles of God.
Yeah, that's right.
That quality includes... The realization...
No. The particle is included in the whole, not the whole in the particle.
The quality doesn't include the...